Well, greetings again, brethren. Good to see all of you. I have been wanting to go through something that I mentioned to you recently, which is I wrote this article for the magazine on the Palestinians, and I wanted to turn that into a sermon as well. A couple reasons. One is I spent so much time and energy on that, I thought I should at least get an article as well as a sermon out of it. And one thing about with a sermon is I can give a little bit more information that is in the article. The article was actually quite shortened from what I had originally produced. And even what I originally produced was chopped down from what I had myself originally, which there just was a lot of information here that I thought was worthwhile. Another thing I thought was if I can, if we post this, I can maybe call this the expanded version of what's in the magazine. So if anybody wants more on this, they can look at or they can listen. A lot of people like to listen to things instead of necessarily read them. They could listen and get a little bit more from it. So I want to get right into this. And I imagine, some of you probably already read this article, but maybe some of you haven't. And even if you have, there's going to be more information in this than what you heard or what you saw when you read it the first time. So this article is titled, Who Are the Palestinians? And the Israeli Jews are regularly accused of invading and occupying land that's not theirs, the land of Palestine that purportedly belongs to the indigenous Palestinian people. But just who are the Palestinians? Is the land theirs? What is the truth? Well, to the Arab nations, the birth of the Jewish state in Israel in 1948 is not a cause for celebration, but a remembrance of what they call the Nakba, or disaster, or catastrophe. The declaration of Israeli statehood was followed immediately by invasion by surrounding Arab nations who told non-Jewish Muslim inhabitants of the land that was then called Palestine, mostly Arabs themselves, to join the struggle or temporarily evacuate while the Israelis were conquered, to then return to a Jew-free country. You might know the word Judenrein from Germany, the Nazis. So a Jew-free country, and many did. Many either joined the struggle or they fled. A lot of them fled within the country, within the area. They didn't necessarily leave. They just left where their homes were. But events didn't go as planned. The Israeli Jews defeated the Arab forces. And the inhabitants who had left and cooperated with the invaders became displaced, most relocating to Arab countries where they were not absorbed into the general populace, but lived as refugees. I mean, we were in Jordan and we saw a huge area of these camps where these people just live there. They're not integrated into the regular society. A similar situation occurred nearly 20 years later in the 1967 Six-Day War, resulting in many more fleeing or being expelled and joining the refugees in Arab countries. The non-Jewish inhabitants of the land, formerly called Palestine, including the many of them who scattered as refugees, came to be known as the Palestinians. Most of these people now live in Jordan, and I think Jordan's even like 75% Palestinian. This is a very high number. So many in camps and many making up the rest of the population. Most live in Jordan in the territories known as the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and in lesser numbers in Syria and Lebanon, along with various other countries. They're often portrayed, and they portray themselves, as indigenous people of the land. They say it's properly called Palestine or Philistine in Arabic. The claim is made that the Zionist Jews who migrated to the land from the late 1800s to the mid-1900s had no legitimate national claim to the land, land they were supposedly stealing from the long-established ancient Palestinians. The Jews are accused of a Western takeover of land that properly belongs to the Muslim people there. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas recently said that Israel is, quote, a colonial enterprise that has nothing to do with Jewishness, as if the Jews are foreign invaders of Palestinian land. Now, I won't give you all the citations here in this, but they are in the magazine. So some of these quotes that I give, if there's quotes that are not from there, I'll give those. But a lot of these sources are already there, so I don't want to take time to go through all of those. Or if you need them, you can ask me as well. So is that what actually happened 70 years ago, this Western colonialization by these Zionists, and in the decades before and after? To whom does the land of Israel, or should it be called Palestine, actually belong? And just who are the Palestinian people? Does the land rightfully belong to them? Let's look at what history and the Bible reveal to answer these questions. So the first part of this we're talking about is, are they indigenous Canaanites or Arabs from elsewhere? Are they indeed? By the way, just the other day I heard this claim again. I couldn't believe it. I thought, is this really still being promoted? And yes, it is. It was just on the radio, or I heard it just again the other day. I couldn't believe they're still saying that yet, but they claim that they're the Canaanites. And maybe a few of them are, but what difference does that make, as we'll see? I mean, it doesn't really mean that much if some of them are. But as will become clear, the idea of a Palestinian people or nation is an invention. No such ethnically or culturally distinct people of this name has ever existed since the biblical Philistines, from which this name derives. It's clear that the Palestinians of today are mostly Arabs, yet from many other areas, along with various other peoples. Palestinian leaders, however, insist on wild claims. In the words of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, this is a quote again, "We said to him, to Netanyahu, when he claimed the Jews have a historical right dating back to 3,000 years BCE, we say that the nation of Palestine upon the land of Canaan had a 7,000 year history. This is the truth that must be said. Netanyahu, you are incidental in history. We are the people of history. We are the owners of history." In fact, I saw another quote where they were saying they go back all the way to creation, which you wonder how those two things square. I mean, it's like they think the Canaanites were there from creation. But yes, I mean, they have these claims. Palestinian leader prior to Abbas, Yasser Arafat, claimed the Palestinians are descendants of the Jebusites, the Canaanite peoples of ancient Jerusalem, you know, that David conquered. It sometimes even strangely maintained, again, that this started at the very, very beginning. You wonder, again, how can that be? Yet consider these words of the Palestinian Hamas Interior and National Security Minister in March 2012. "Who are the Palestinians?" he said. "We have many families, called Al-Masri, the Egyptian, whose roots are Egyptian. They may be from Alexandria, from Cairo, from Dumieta, from the north, from Aswan, from Upper Egypt. We are Egyptians. We are Arabs. We are Muslims. We are part of you, Egyptians. Personally, half my family is Egyptian, and the other half are Saudis." So that kind of tells you right there. The Palestinian last names actually show many other national origins, too. In fact, here are some of the most common family names among the Palestinians. So I'm going to say some of these to you. This is not in the article. Masri is from Egypt. Obviously, Mitzer is Mitzrayim in the Bible for Egypt. But let's see. Kamis is from Bahrain. Al-Faruqi, Mosul, Iraq. Al-Araj is from Morocco, a member of the Saud dynasty. Al-Lubnani, the Lebanese. Al-Mughrabi, the Moroccan. Al-Jazair, the Algerian. Al-Yamani, the Yemeni. Al-Afghani, the Afghan. Al-Hindi, the Indian. Iraqi, from Iraq, obviously. Halabi, from Aleppo, Syria. Al-Baghdadi, from... These are all very common names among the Palestinians. Al-Baghdadi, from Baghdad, Iraq. Tarabulsi, from Tripoli, Lebanon. And Hurani from Huran, Syria, Al-Husseini from Saudi Arabia, Saudi is a name from Saudi Arabia, Metzwara from Egypt, Barda, and that's a lake in Egypt. These are basically tribal names from all these lands, and some of the became the national names. Nashashibi in Syria, Bushnak from Bosnia, we'll talk about that in a little bit, Zoabi from Iraq, Turki from the Turks, Al-Kurd from Kurdistan, Hadadins is from Yemen, Al-Abukisk is some of the Bedouins from Egypt, Al-Shakirat, in fact I'll give you two, and Al-Zabidat and Al-Aramsha, these are all Egyptian Bedouin tribal names, and Abu Sita, which is the father of six, and that's from the year 1700, a well-known knight of the large Al-Tarabin tribe had six slaves. And these people are all descendants of those. So, I mean, you have these small family groups that have grown quite large today. And so you have many nations there represented. Even Yasser Arafat, the most famous Palestinian leader of the PLO, was not native to Judea. He called himself a Palestinian refugee, but spoke Arabic with an Egyptian accent because he was born in 1929, Cairo, Egypt. He served in the Egyptian army, studied in the University of Cairo, and lived in Cairo until 1956. His full name was Muhammad Abdel Rahman Abdel Rauf Arafat Al-Qudwa Al-Husseini. And Al-Qudwa shows his tribal origins. These people, who are they? They're just from all these Arab countries all over the place that have somehow ended up there. Note what they are not. A unique people group indigenous to ancient Palestine. In fact, Arafat and his compatriots admitted as much. Joseph Farah at WND.com pointed out, way back on March 31st, 1977, the Dutch newspaper Trouw published an interview with the Palestinian Liberation Organization Executive Committee member Zakir Moussain. Here's what he said. Quote, "The Palestinian people does not exist. The creation of a Palestinian state is only a means for continuing our struggle against the state of Israel for our Arab unity. In reality, today, there is no difference between Jordanians, Palestinians, Syrians, and Lebanese. Only for political and tactical reasons do we speak today about the existence of a distinct Palestinian people to oppose Zionism. For tactical reasons, Jordan, which is a sovereign state with defined borders, cannot raise claims to Haifa and Jaffa. While as a Palestinian, I can undoubtedly demand Haifa, Jaffa, Beersheba, and Jerusalem. However, the moment we reclaim our right to all of Palestine, we will not wait even a minute to unite Palestine and Jordan." That's pretty clear, isn't it? Farah says. Arafat himself made a very definitive and unequivocal statement along these lines as late as 1993. Yasser Arafat proudly stated in his authorized biography that, quote, "If there is any such thing as a Palestinian people, it is I, Yasser Arafat, who created them." In fact, the first article in the 1964 Palestine Liberation Organization's charter declares, quote, "Palestine is an Arab homeland bound by strong Arab national ties to the rest of the Arab countries, which together form the great Arab homeland." Now, it's interesting, in our article on this in the magazine, you might have seen the top of this. Flip to it. There's a picture of a flag up here. You see the black, white, and green, and the red part right there on the left side. Well, when I saw this, by the way, I wrote this article first before it obviously went into layout. And then when I saw that this was being used in the layout, I sent a message to Scott Ashley saying, you know, Scott, if I'd known that you were going to feature this flag, I might have noted that it is nearly the same as that of Jordan, as the flag of the Arab revolt, as the flag of the old Arab kingdom of Syria, and the flag of the Hashemite kingdom of Hejaz. You look at all these flags, they're almost identical. Now, according to Jordan's, one of them has like a star on this red field. But I mean, these are very similar, or they might have the black and green flipped, but they're really the same, essentially the same flag. And according to Jordan's official website, it says that the black band is for the Arab Abbasid dynasties. The white is for the Umayyad dynasties. The green is for the Fatimid dynasties. And the crimson triangle is for the Hashemite dynasty. So that's the flag of the Palestinians too. Surprise. We're talking about the same group here for the most part, although there are a few differences we'll talk about later. Palestinian, I will note next here, was originally a designation for the Jews. I have that with a question mark. And the answer is yes. In terms of the land, there's quite a problem in the PLO charter statement, seeing it as an Arab homeland and not a Jewish homeland. In fact, it should be pointed out that the Palestinians do not consider only the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as Palestinian territories occupied by Israel. They regard the whole of what is called the land of Israel to be the land of Palestine belonging to the Palestinians, with all of it illegally occupied by the Jewish state. So when they talk about the occupied lands, they're not just talking about the West Bank and Gaza Strip, they're talking about the whole country. They say it's illegally occupied by the Israelis. Ironically, the West Bank bears this name as denoting territory that Jordan annexed and occupied on the west side of the Jordan after 1948, rather than it being called East Palestine. Notice that it's on the east side of the land of Israel, but it's not East Palestine. It's the West Bank, the west side of Jordan, that Jordan had annexed. While the Jews call this territory that's called the West Bank, the Jews call this Judea and Samaria, the very heartland of the ancient Israelite kingdoms of Judah and Israel. In fact, the Jews don't like to call it the West Bank. They refer to call it like Shomron is Samaria for the northern part, and Yehuda, the Judah for the southern part. Even more ironic is the fact that before, this is a quote from Daniel Gringlas in Jerusalem Post, before the state of Israel was born, the term Palestinians was used by the Jews to refer to themselves and their organizations. The Palestine Post, the Palestine Foundation Fund, Palestine Airways, the Palestine Symphony Orchestra were all purely Jewish enterprises. Indeed, the term Palestine was Western and was regularly used by Jews who immigrated to the country. The Zionists called themselves Palestinians, while the Arabs simply identified themselves as Arabs. The Zionist institutions, such as the Anglo-Palestine Bank, the Palestine Post, again, and so on, were Palestinian, really Jewish, whereas the Arab institutions, such as the Arab Higher Committee, were simply Arab. The terminology later shifted dramatically. We first hear, this is a quote again from Gringlas, says, we first hear of Arabs referred to as Palestinians when Egypt's President Nasser, with help from the Russian KGB, established the Palestine Liberation Organization in 1964. It was only during the 1970s that the newly minted Palestinians began promoting their narrative through murder and assassination. The Arabs have justified their attacks as acts of the indigenous people struggling for national liberation. So they're freedom fighters. You know, they're trying to free their land from these oppressive occupiers from the West. But that is not what's happening here. Our next section is from Canaanite to Jewish possession, or Jewish dispossession, sorry, from Canaanite to Jewish dispossession, later to be reversed, the Bible says. And in fact, I'd like you to turn in your Bibles over to Genesis, if you would. Genesis chapter 11. And I'll just note something there. Let's briefly examine the history of this land and of its being referred to as Palestine. It's true that this was the land of Canaan. And the Bible calls it that. This is there in Genesis 11:31. You can just look there at that verse and see that it's very specifically the land of Canaan in the Bible. And I'll give you a couple other references too. Chapter 12, verse 5. Again, it's Canaan. Chapter 13, verse 12. This was properly the land of Canaan. Now, when it was the land of Canaan, though, the Bible also talks about how the Philistines dwelled along the Mediterranean coast. Because you might remember, like, the king Abimelech that Isaac had dealings with was a Philistine leader there along the Mediterranean coast, was occupied by the Philistines. These were people from the west, probably from the Aegean area, like where the Greeks were from. And although they were actually descendants of Egypt, they were Egyptians' descendants, the Peleset, I guess, who became the Philistines. So in other words, these were various peoples that had settled here at the time. And they were there before the Hebrew patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their descendants, the Israelites, settled here. Yet God, the Creator, who owns the world and everyone in it, stated His intention to evict the original inhabitants of the land. I mean, we see that. He's going to send the Canaanites out and give it to His people, Israel. We first see a hint of that here in Genesis 12. If you look at Genesis 12, in verses 5 through 7, it says, I turned off of there what I shouldn't have. It says that God is going to give, here we are. Then Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. And Abram passed through the land. And it even says, and the Canaanites were then in the land. It says the end of that verse. Then the Lord, in verse 7, appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. And of course we see over in chapter 17, Genesis 17 and verse 8, it says, also I give to you and your descendants after you the land which you in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as what? As an everlasting possession. And I will be their God. And you can also see this in other verses. But of course, this is referring to Abraham's descendants. And a lot of people might say, well, Abraham's descendants, that includes the Arabs. Which it does. The Arabs are descendants from Abraham. Because Ishmael is descended from Abraham. Edom was the brother, it was Esau, the brother of Jacob, brother of Israel. So you might say, well, it belongs to all of them too. But we get more specifics here as we go along of who actually possessed this land. In Exodus 13, verse 5, is, I'll just mention to you, that is a direct reference to the Israelites, being that this land of Canaan is going to be given to the Israelites. In Exodus 13, 5 and 11. And also in Deuteronomy 1, 7 through 8, it says that this land is being given to the Israelites. Specifically. So not just all of Abraham's descendants, but the Israelites. So even if there were, by the way, indigenous remnants of the Canaanites here, which the Palestinians claim they're descendants of Canaanites, the land would not belong to them by divine decree. And in fact, it doesn't belong to them even though they are descendants of Abraham. Because it's specifically the Israelites that are given this land. The Israelites formed a nation and a kingdom that became divided in two, we understand, Israel and Judah. And after persistent sin, God allowed the northern tribes of Israel to be deported by the Assyrians and the southern people of Judah, the Jews, to be mostly carried away to Babylon, with a few remaining in the land, some later returning to revive a Jewish state under the rule of the Persians, continuing under the Greeks and the Romans. The Romans crushed two Jewish revolts in AD 70 and 135, and the Jews then became mostly scattered, although a significant, and this is important, a significant population of Jews always remained in the land. In fact, you might have heard, there's the Babylonian Talmud, there's the Jewish Talmud, sometimes called the Palestinian Talmud. That was because that's where the center of rabbinic activity that was continuing up in the northern part of Israel continued for hundreds of years there, even after, you know, this time period. The Jews were expelled from Jerusalem in 135, but a number remained in other communities in the Holy Land. Now, it might be thought that God's expulsion of Israel and Judah from the land means their claim on it came to an end. Just as with the ancient Canaanites. Look, the Canaanites were vomited out of the land. Later, the Israelites and the Jews were vomited out of the land. They were taken out. But there's a big difference. Because God gave this land to the descendants of Israel forever. And again, we can see that back in Genesis 13:15. That it was given to Abraham's descendants forever. But again, somebody might say, but that's also the Arabs. But we see in, I'll just refer you a few of these verses. In Genesis 26:3, God said he was giving the land to Isaac. In Genesis 28:13-14, he said he was giving it to Jacob. And now I want you to turn over to Exodus 32. Exodus 32 gives us something very specific. It says in Exodus 32, verse 13, it says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. This is actually a prayer to God from Moses. He's trying to remind God about his commitments to not destroy the Israelites. He says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of, I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So that was going to be the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob specifically would receive this land forever. But of course, then they were kicked out. What about that? Let's flip over to Deuteronomy chapter 4. I want you to notice something over here. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, told something very interesting in verse 40. You have something here that's conditional and unconditional. I want you to see this in Deuteronomy 4 and verse 40. It says, "You shall therefore keep the statutes, his God's statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land." Notice this. So there's a conditional part. If you want to prolong your days in this land, you have to be obedient specifically. But it says, in the land which the Lord, your God, is giving you for all time. It's theirs. Even if they get run out, it's theirs. And they are to be, you know, and the, God even, when he warned of removing them from the land, and even after he actually did remove them from the land, he often spoke of bringing the people of Israel and Judah back here, of regathering them in their homeland. So according to God, who sets the boundaries of nations, we're told that in the Bible too, no other people has a right to this land, and all would do well to remember that. It's very critical whose land this is. Now I want to talk a little bit about the history of the term Palestine. Concerning the name Palestine, which, as I mentioned, you know, came from the Philistines originally, when the Romans quashed the Jewish revolt of 135, they merged the Roman province of Judea into Syria and called the new province Syria-Palestina, presumably to remove its Jewish distinction. Now, some people think that the Romans were in this renaming throwing the Jews' ancient enemy, the Philistines, into their faces. But the Philistines were long gone, and the Romans likely gave them little thought. I don't think the Romans were going, let's see, we'll name it, you know, after the Philistines, because that was the Jews' enemy. Like they even knew Jewish history. I mean, you know, most of the leadership probably didn't, although many scholars probably did. The fact is, this term Palestine, while derived from the ancient Philistines, had become a common geographic distinction for the land well before the renaming. This term used by such Greek and Roman writers as Herodotus, Aristotle, Ovid, Pliny the Elder, Plutarch, and others. In fact, it may surprise some to learn that it was even used a few times by the first century Jewish historians Philo of Alexandria and Flavius Josephus. They actually called it Palestine in some places too. So they didn't see that as some affront to the Jews to call it that. It's just that's what it was known as in the world. And when you are writing to an audience of the world, a lot of times you're going to give that geographic land description as opposed to the political entity that sat on that land. That's just what the area, the territory was called. But then it actually became known politically as Syria-Palestina. In the later Byzantine period, the province of Syria-Palestina was reorganized into, you know, three different areas, into Palestina Prima, as number one, Palestina Secunda, second, you know, and Palestina Salutaris. Purely geographic distinctions that were picked up later by the Muslim Arab caliphates. They referred to the first, that is Palestina Prima, which is more or less today's Jerusalem area, and the Shephelah, that is the area of the coastal plain, you know, more toward Tel Aviv, as Yund Philistine. That's what they call it. The Arabs called it Yund Philistine. Yund means army, J-U-N-D. In other words, the name did not signify the national identity of a Palestinian people who lived in the land, but instead a military district in line with the Byzantine nomenclature that already existed. So this was a military division in that region, was called Yund Philistine. Then under the Turkish Ottoman Empire, you know, from 1517 to 1917, the term Palestine was used as a general term to describe the land south of Syria. It was not an official designation. In fact, many Ottomans and Arabs who lived in Palestine during this time referred to the area as southern Syria and not as Palestine. After World War I, when the Ottomans fell to the Western Allies, the name Palestine was applied to the territory that was placed under a British mandate. So the British took over, and this area included not only present-day Israel, but also present-day Jordan. and they called that Palestine. That was under the British mandate, Palestine. At that time, it was common for the international press to label Jews, not Arabs, living in the mandate as Palestinians, as I had mentioned before. Actually, the official distinction for the land in Hebrew documents under the British mandate, so when the British produced documents for the, you know, for the, in Hebrew, for the Jews, the name, and you even find this on certain images and stuff, the name of the British mandate was Palestine EY, in parentheses, EY, which is actually the English equivalent of Aleph Yud, which is the initials for Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. So it's Palestine EY, Palestine abbreviation for land of Israel in Hebrew. And the Arab leadership saw this compromise as a violation of the mandate terms. Some Arab politicians suggested there should be a similar Arabic concession, such as southern Syria. See, they didn't like Palestine. They wanted southern, and they definitely didn't like the EY, but they wanted southern Syria. The British authorities rejected this proposal. Clearly the Arabs under British rule here did not identify themselves as Palestinians. So then I want to talk about the land and its inhabitants from the Byzantine to the Islamic periods. What was the makeup of the land of Israel after the Romans crushed the Jewish revolts in AD 70 and 135? As mentioned, most of the Jews were forcibly removed or fled, yet many others still remained throughout the land. The Romans would encourage others to settle here, particularly after the empire became officially Christian. And when the, so they've got a bunch of people from parts of the Byzantine Empire in the East Mediterranean who were Christians moved into that land. And then when the Muslim Arabs took control of the Holy Land from the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire in the 7th century, no doubt many of them settled in the conquered land, many of these Arab Muslims who came in, with the Jews remaining the largest minority. But it's been argued that, and this is from Shlomo Sherman, The Myth of the So-Called Palestinians in 1994 at Daniel Pipes' forum, I just thought this is very interesting, that many of the native population, that is when you think about when the Muslims took over, that many of the native population, both Jewish and non-Jewish at that time meant Christian. So you had basically a lot of people who were Jews or Greek Christians. And when I say Greek, I don't mean just from Greece. I mean from that whole region around there. Many of these people that were there in the land were forcefully converted to Islam, and the country was forcefully Arabized, becoming an Arab-speaking country. That does not mean the people living there were real Arabs. They were, in fact, descendants of the original Jewish population and of the Greek-speaking population that the Byzantines imported to Christianize the land. So a lot of the people there that are supposedly these Muslim Arabs aren't really real Arabs. They were actually even Jews who were made to convert to Islam, and many Christians from other places that were made to convert to Islam. Now later, it was not the Arabs, but the Seljuk Turks and the Kurds under Kurdish leader Saladin. You've probably heard of him, the great, you know, during the Kurds, the great Muslim leader was Saladin, but he was not an Arab. He was a Kurd. They fought the European Crusaders in the Holy Land. Many of these non-Arab Muslims were stationed here, and Saladin sent many to protect the land against the Arab Bedouins. They were actually trying to keep them at bay, these Arab Bedouins. As a result, numerous Hebron families are of Kurdish origin. The Kurds also settled in other parts of the country and Transjordan. And by now, the Kurds have completely Arabized, meaning that they, you know, because of the Arabs have swamped them, and so they've all become essentially, quote, Arab, and they retain no connection to their origins. But you can see in a lot of these family names and stuff where these people are really from. But as we will see, there will be much more assimilation of foreigners here in this land. The indigenous people of the land were still the Jews. This is a quote that I want to mention that came from Daniel Pipes' forum as well. The noted Arab historian Ibn Khaldun called one of the greatest historians of all time by Arnold Toynbee, observed that as late as A.D. 1400, the land was still permeated with Jewish culture and customs. Nearly 300 years after Arab rule ended, there was still no evidence of Palestinian roots or established culture. So, I mean, this was pretty clear what was happening there for a long time. In fact, there were actually far fewer people here in general by this point. In the late 1600s, during Ottoman rule, a geographer and language expert named Hadriani Rolandi toured the land, surveying about 2,500 places where people lived that were mentioned in the Bible or the Mishnah. And this is a quote from an article that is quoted in the magazine by Avi Goldreich at thinkisrael.org. Notes that this book by Hadriani Rolandi in the late 1600s, his most prominent conclusions, one, not one settlement in the land of Israel has a name that is of Arabic origin. Two, most of the land was empty, desolate, and the inhabitants few in number, and mostly concentrated in the towns Jerusalem, Akko, Tzvat, and Jaffa, Tiberias, and Gaza. Most of the inhabitants were Jews. In the late 1600s, most of the inhabitants were Jews, and the rest, Christians. There were a few Muslims, mostly nomad Bedouins, who arrived in the area as construction and agricultural labor reinforcement seasonal workers. So these were brought in, you know, infrequently. Number three, the book totally contradicts any postmodern theory claiming a Palestinian heritage or Palestinian nation. End quote. The population dwindled as various factors made it increasingly difficult to live here. The ruin of the land had begun with the Roman destruction of Judah. Roman historian Cassius Dio writing at the time that, quote, the whole of Judea became a desert after the destruction of many hundreds of towns and villages. It was 900-something towns. They were just destroyed, and this just allowed this whole desert and swampy areas to develop. Yet things became far worse after the Arab conquest and later under Ottoman rule. In the latter period, the land, and this is from a video presentation of the Galilee experience that we saw back in 1997 over in Israel, it says, quote, the land had become nearly desolate. The Turkish government taxed landowners by the number of trees on their land. The forests were decimated in an effort to avoid the tax. Hills and plains were overgrazed by sheep and goats. Large tracts ceased to be cultivated and lost their fertility. Many cities were abandoned. Swamps and deserts encroached upon the battered landscape. The fabled Holy Land had sunk into a sleeping death. And then in 1799, the French leader Napoleon Bonaparte, attempting to expand his empire through the Middle East, sought to secure a passageway through the Holy Land. Having, and this is a quote, from the same presentation, outflanked a gigantic Turkish army, Napoleon renewed his siege on the port of Akko. But the Turks were aided by a fleet of British warships, and the French fled Akko. Napoleon retreated south. Crushed by one of the worst defeats of his military career, he set fire to everything in his path, villages, crops, and landscapes. This land was already in bad shape. But one of his aides wrote, to our right was the sea, to our left and behind us, the desert we were creating. So visitors to the land in the 1700s and 1800s commented on its forlorn desolation. The British consul in Palestine reported in 1857, quote, the country is in a considerable degree empty of inhabitants, and therefore its greatest need is that of a body of population, end quote. The most famous one to speak of the land's condition was the American author Mark Twain in his book The Innocents Abroad after his visit in 1867. I've seen people who've tried to play this down. You know, many of these things they try to play down because there's, of course, arguments on the other side of this. But, I mean, it's pretty clear what this country was abysmally forlorn and desolate. He said, in one location after another, Twain registered gloom at his findings. Quote, stirring scenes occur in the valley, Jezreel. No more. There's not a solitary village throughout its whole extent, not for 30 miles in either direction. In fact, according to Twain, even the Bedouin raiders who attacked so fiercely had been imported. These weren't like people that were actually normally there. They were brought in, quote, Twain said, provided for the occasion, shipped from Jerusalem by the Arabs who guarded each group of pilgrims. The whole thing being a facade for mutual profit. See, they made a deal. They brought these Bedouins out to try to attack, but they defend, and then they pay the guard. So they pay bakshish. That's what the gratuity to your protectors, who they say. He said he saw them walk out there and mingle together. They were all buddy-buddy. It was a scam. He further wrote of, quote, these unpeopled deserts, these rusty mounds of barrenness, that melancholy ruin of Capernaum. We reached Tabor safely. We never saw a human being on the whole route when they were, you know, marching through big parts of the country. Now I want to talk about Bosnians and other people joined in a hodgepodge. Now, there had been an influx of some people earlier in the 1830s with the invasion and temporary occupation of Syria and Palestine by the Egyptian general Ibrahim Pasha. He left behind a number of permanent Egyptian colonies. And so you did, you know, even before later Arabs came in, you had a lot of Egyptians that came in at that time. And with the Jewish people returning to the land in the later 1800s, the Ottomans brought in other people to the land as well. Now, when I say a lot, though, this was still a pretty desolate place. But, I mean, compared to nobody, this was something that you had more of these people come in. A major step came with the Bosnians. The Balkan country of Bosnia was invaded and forced converted to Islam by the Ottomans in the 1300s. So that's all the way, you know, up to the north. And for five centuries, it was fought over. Starting in the late 1600s, the Ottomans began to lose European territories. Then in 1878, at the Congress of Berlin, Turkey lost Bosnia to Austria. The result was a stream of Muslim refugees pouring out of Bosnia looking for haven in the Ottoman Empire. This migration of Muslim refugees marked a very important historic milestone in the history of Palestine. The Ottoman rulers adopted a policy of Muslim colonization. In the Carmel region, in the Galilee, in the plain of Sharon, and in the Caesarea, lands were distributed to the Muslim refugees from Bosnia and Herzegovina. The refugees were further attracted by 12-year tax exemptions from military and from exemption from military service. That's according to Manfred Lehmann at Bosnia, motherland of Palestinians. But actually, it says the name Bushnak. This is from Wikipedia, that the name Bushnak, meaning Bosnian or Bosniak, is a surname common among the Palestinians who are of Bosnian origin. So there's a lot of Bosnians among the Palestinians. And in fact, I didn't really have time to go into this, but it's interesting, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, this Islamic leader who kind of teamed up with Adolf Hitler, and they wanted to, you know, get rid of a lot of the Jews, he ended up in Europe, and he ended up doing a lot of work for the Nazis up in Bosnia. So a lot of Muslims were still up in Bosnia, and you had this Bosnian Holy Land connection that was still going on for a while, even up to World War II there. Now, the same colonization policy was also directed toward Muslim refugees from Russia, particularly from Georgia, the Crimea, and the Caucasus, a diverse people group called the Circassians. They were from that area, and the Turkmenians, leading to their settling in Abu Ghosh near Jerusalem and in the Golan Heights. Refugees from Algeria and Egypt were also settled in Jaffa, Gaza, Jericho, and the Golan. So here you had people coming up down from Russia, you have people from Algeria, all over the place. But all these and other immigrants of widely disparate and mixed heritage form part of the basis for the so-called Palestinian people. Among the peoples counted as indigenous Palestinians are those in this remarkable list, which combines a few sources, such as John of Würzburg and some people at Daniel Pipes and several other sources have tracked these down. But I combine these lists, and here you go. Here is the background for these earlier Palestinians. Okay, Greeks, Syrians, Latins, Egyptians, Turks, Armenians, Italians, Persians, Kurds, Germans, Afghans, Circassians, Bosnians, Sudanese, Samaritans, Algerians, Tatars, Germans, Hungarians, Scots, Bretons, English, Franks, Bohemians, Bulgarians, Georgians, Indians, Copts, Norse, Danes, Frisians, Russians, Nubians, Senegalese, Druze, a host of Arabs from many countries, and some Jews. In short, quote, the greatest human agglomeration drawn together in one small area of the globe. Quote. Now, some of the European elements likely stem from people who came to the Holy Land to fight in the Crusades and centuries of Islamic slave trade. Yet most of those on this list make up a very small part of today's Palestinians, the major exception being the Arabs. So the next section here is the Arabs swarm in. The Arabs swarm in the real colonial enterprise. The Jews returning to the land in the late 1800s and the early 1900s as part of the Zionist movement during the time of the British Mandate sparked further immigration from surrounding Arab countries. Indeed, this migration was so large as to overwhelm and assimilate the earlier non-Jewish immigrants, leading to all being essentially Arabized and regarded as Arabs. Now, listen to this. The indigenous, the people that were there before all these Arabs swarm in, the indigenous 4.3%, that's what they are of the Palestinians today, they're probably about 4.3%, all those people I just mentioned, are today about 4.3%, comprise many non-Arab nationalities, but all of them were swamped by the Arab immigrants and within a few generations largely lost their identity. So when all these Arabs started migrating in, it kind of bred out a lot of all these other people. And records show that, and this is referring to a book by Joan Peters in this quote from Daniel Pipes' forum. Records show it was during the 19th and 20th century Jewish settlement and the resulting employment opportunities that drew successive waves of Arab immigrants to Palestine. That's what they were coming for. The Arab population shows a remarkable increase, partly due to the import of Jewish capital into Palestine and other factors associated with the growth of the Jewish national home. Such as cultivating the land too. You know, this land that was devastated. The Peel Commission report said that in 1937. It's early reported that, quote, in the Jewish settlement Rishon LeZion, which is the first to Zion, founded in 1882, by the year 1889, the 40 Jewish families settled there. Now look at that, from 1882 to 1889. 1882, 40 Jewish families settled there, and by 1889, that it attracted more than 400 Arab families to this place. And many other Arab villages had sprouted in the same fashion. So they just gathered in around all these Jews that had migrated there. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill said of Palestine in 1939, far from being persecuted, the Arabs have crowded into the country. And Churchill had earlier stated, this wasn't in the article, quote, the Arabs would have sat in the dark forever had not the Zionist engineers harnessed the Jordan River for electrification. Now they swarm into Palestine in seeking the light. That's remarkable. And this large-scale migration into the land continued up to the formation of the Israeli state, when most Muslims living in Palestine had been living there for fewer than 60 years. According to an article by Ezekiel Doiney and the Muslim colonists from Gatestone Institute. Mideast expert Daniel Pipes, in reviewing the book From Time Immemorial, The Origins of the Arab-Jewish Conflict Over Palestine, which, by the way, I'm just going to mention this. She's written a pretty comprehensive book. I have this book, and it is filled with basically uncontested facts. But even Pipes admits that, you know, the way she writes it is very polemical and also, maybe not in a balanced way, in very, you know, pro-Israel and anti-Arabs in that sense. However, the facts that she presents are real facts. That if not, whenever they attack her book, they're attacking, you know, how she describes things and a lot of the emotional invective that's in there, as opposed to the actual facts, which are pretty solid. And she, anyway, Pipe says that the data unearthed by Joan Peters indicate that Arabs benefited economically so much by the presence of Jewish settlers from Europe that they traveled hundreds of miles to get closer to them. In turn, this explains why the definition of a refugee from Palestine in 1948 is a person who lived there for just 2 years. 2 years! If they got there 2 years before the 1948 invasion, they were able to be classed as these refugees. Because many Arab residents in 1948 had immigrated so recently, end quote. Thus, as Daniel Greenfield states, the Palestinians are what they always were, a foreign Islamic Arab colony inside Israel. And he pointedly answers Mahmoud Abbas's claim of a Zionist colonial enterprise at the outset, declaring, quote, the Palestinians are not the victims of colonialism, they are its perpetrators. So the last part here is that the Bible indicts Edom. The Bible indicts Edom. All this being said, you know, we've got all these Arabs in there. There does seem to be, in consideration of what Scripture tells us on the issue, more to the identity of the Palestinian Arabs. I'd like you to turn over to Obadiah 19. Well, we won't look at the verse first, but we'll look at the book of Obadiah. But over in the book of Obadiah, we'll see the focus here. Amos. There you go, Amos. That's right. It's tucked in there really tightly. You know, like one page probably in your Bible, maybe crossed over onto another one. But anyway, there is more to the identity of the Palestinian Arabs beyond just being part of the general mass of Arab people. The Arabs are not monolithic in their heritage. They consider themselves to be descended mainly from Isaac's brother Ishmael, the first son of Abraham. And that is evidently the case. You've got but you also see the Hagarites, which was Hagar, was the mother of Ishmael. But all these, there is a number of Arab tribes, even that are non-Ishmaelite. But most of them probably are the Ishmaelites in that sense. And other descendants of Abraham too. Yet among the Arabs, I noted here, are some elements from other early tribes, including that of Jacob's brother Esau, who was renamed Edom. Esau intermarried with the daughters of Ishmael and the Canaanites. So you do have some Canaanite blood maybe in that land. So, and maybe, like I said, there may be some remnants of the Canaanites who were there. But remember, the Canaanites were dispossessed and the land was given to the Israelites. You might even have some Philistines among those people, although I think they mostly migrated away from that land. But even if they were, they're such a tiny part of the population. And again, the land wasn't given to them. It was all those people were dispossessed and the land was given to the Israelites. But talking about Esau, it should be further realized that Esau's descendants, the Edomites, are not limited to Arab tribes, but include various other peoples, because they got pretty scattered too. Now, why focus on Edom here in regard to the Palestinian Arabs? The answer is found in this remarkable prophecy in the book of Obadiah, which concerns what will happen to the Edomites in the end time. And verse 19 is very interesting, because it is speaking of territories, stating that those who control particular territories in the Holy Land will come to possess additional territories there. In context, we can see, and if you read the whole book, you'll be able to see this, that the Israelites in this verse are retaking areas that the Edomites have stolen. Now, fascinatingly, the areas that are listed here, and by the way, you can continue this to the end of the book and see this is an end-time prophecy very clearly. This whole prophecy is about the deliverance coming and the Savior's coming. This is all toward the end. Fascinating, the area listed as doing the taking in verse 19 are areas that are today populated by the Jews. And the areas being taken back are now populated by the Palestinians, thus apparently identifying the Palestinians as the Edomites, at least in significant measure. I'm going to also notice the wording here. It says the south, or the Negev, which is the Negev desert to the south of Israel, in the southern part of the land, which is now held by the Israelis, shall possess the mountains of Esau. What's that? That's talking about southern Jordan. Esau is the land of Edom, and that was in southern Jordan, and perhaps the area around Hebron. If you have a map of the land in the back of your Bible, you might might look at this, and you can kind of see this too. That is the southern West Bank that is now populated by the Palestinians. And I will just say that's because that land in the southern, between the Negev and to the south of Jerusalem, that area became known in even the first century, that land became known as Idumea because the Edomites had taken over that area. And by the way, Herod the Great was an Idumean. He was considered a Jewish king, but he was an Edomite, basically. So southern Jordan, as well as probably this area of the southern West Bank, is being taken over by those who control the Negev, that is the Jews today. And the lowland, that's the Shephelah, which is the lower hills between the central hill country to the east and the coastal plain to the west. So if you're looking at a map, it's the long part that's right between the coastland and the central hill country where Jerusalem is right on the spine, the central hill country. But the lower hills are the area between that part and the coastal plain. So there's a flat land by the plain of the Mediterranean. But in the middle is the Shephelah, the lowland. It says that the lowland, the Shephelah, which is populated by Jews, shall possess Philistia, which is on the coast, most of which is now the Gaza Strip, which is now held by the Palestinians. So you see that? The people that control this land inside the coast are going to control the coast. And it says, they, that is the same Jewish Shephelah inhabitants, shall possess the fields of Ephraim and the fields of Samaria or Shomron, which is the northern West Bank that is now occupied by the Palestinians. So the people who control the Shephelah on this area, they're going to take over the Philistine coast over here, and they're going to take over inland and north. They're going to take over Ephraim and Samaria. They're going to take over the northern West Bank. So already these areas that are controlled by Jews are going to take over they're going to take over the Gaza Strip. They're going to take over the area of the southern West Bank, the area of Hebron. They're going to take over the northern West Bank. And it says, Benjamin, which is the area around Jerusalem, which is presently held by the Israelis, shall possess Gilead. And that is northern Jordan. And actually, it's also up by where the Golan Heights are and all that kind of stuff. It's the areas that Syria claimed, but this is saying it's all going to be controlled now by the Jews. And Jordan's population is heavily Palestinian. So this Palestinian territory now is going to be taken over by these people who now live in the area of Benjamin, which is of Jerusalem, the Jews. So there's not, you know, time to go into detail here, but it appears also that Esau's descendants range farther abroad as well, being found today among the Turks and other peoples. It could be that some of the disparate peoples making up the non-Jewish, non-Arab inhabitants of the Holy Land prior to the more recent Arab influx are also made up of Edomites to some degree. And we talk about that in the Bible reading program on this section of Obadiah. Now, God further prophesies, I'm going to give you a few more verses here before we close. If you look over to Ezekiel 35, Ezekiel 35 and 36, God gives prophecies against them. I'm going to just see, I marked these verses down, but I'm not sure what chapter. I want to make sure I'm looking at the right one. Oh, here, he warns in chapter 35. And this is, I believe, verse 10. And by the way, the Edomites had a history of this. When the Babylonians invaded and they took over the Jewish lands of Judea, the Edomites tried to take over their land back then. In fact, they did. That's why I was saying they moved in into the southern land, and that whole area became known as Idumea. But this is their pattern. They've been doing this historically, and we see that they're going to be doing it up to the end time, this very same thing. And these prophecies in Ezekiel are dual. They referred back to what was going on at that time of Ezekiel, but they are also very clearly end time prophecies as well. And it says, because you, this is in chapter 35, starting verse 10 here, because you, that is Mount Seir, the land of Edom, Mount Seir is Edom, have said, these two nations and these two countries, talking about Israel and Judah, the whole land of Israel, shall be mine, and we will possess them, although the Lord was there. This is God's land. Therefore, as I live, says the Lord God, I will do according to the envy which you showed in your hatred against them, and I will make myself known among them when I judge you. Now, I'm going to skip down here. I guess we're going up through verse 15. I have heard, let's see, I'm trying to look where I've got this written. I have heard all your blasphemies which you have spoken, there it is in verse 12, which you have spoken against the mountains of Israel, saying, they are desolate. They are given to us to consume. They're desolate land. They're given to us to consume. Thus, with your mouth, you have boasted against me and multiplied your words against me. I have heard them. You shall be desolate, O Mount Seir, as well as all of Edom, all of it, God says. It's because they want to take over that land of God's people. They're going to pay for that, he says. And then he says in chapter 36, and this is in verse 5 here of chapter 36, we're continuing against Edom here. It says, surely I have spoken in my burning jealousy against the rest of the nations and against all Edom, who gave my land to themselves as a possession with wholehearted joy and spiteful minds in order to plunder its open country. Serious stuff here. And God says he will end the shame, in this chapter he says he will end the shame that his land has borne and bring back the people of Israel to at last make abundant use of it. Amazingly, through many prophecies, we learn that the return of the Jewish people today is only a small foretaste of a far greater return of all Israel to the promised land under the coming reign of the Jewish Messiah, the Savior of all peoples, Jesus Christ. It will shock many to learn that the Palestinian Arabs are the ones now wrongly occupying the land that God gave to the people of Israel forever. But as I note in the article, rest assured, he will not allow things to go on as they are indefinitely. All will come to pass just as he promises. Let us all keep looking to God's word and to the clear facts of history to understand our world and trust in God's plan to ultimately set all things right.